Welcome to FinTech Family Hour. This is Zach Anderson Pettit, U.S. Content Director at Money 2020 by day, and your host by night. First things first, FinTech Family Hour is now on YouTube. Please go check it out and subscribe. Our guest this week is Itai Damti, CEO of Unit and a friend of the show since its founding. If you're a fintech nerd, which you probably are, then you probably know about Unit, and you even more likely have likely been following the drama in the banking as a service space. Unit aside, it's been a very heavy news cycle the last couple of months. We cover exactly that. Indirect versus direct, the evolution of Unit, and Itai's evolution as a CEO. If you've been paying attention to the BaaS space, then I have a hunch you're going to find this episode fascinating. This illuminating episode, I've said episode a lot of times, this illuminating episode is brought to you by Skipify. Go to skipify.com to learn more. Without further ado, here's Itai. Itai, my friend, welcome to FinTech Family Hour.
Good to be here, Zach.
It's good to have you. I think we've been trying to organize this interview for something like
4 years.
Four, since the pandemic, but when I was back at MBKC in 2018? 2019?
May 2019.
Because
that's when we started.
I was going to say, you found
ideation phase for Unit was 2019.
Okay. So, I met you pretty early on during that, I think. I think Sheil introduced us.
Yep.
Yeah. That was such a weird time in fintech. And I mean, you had, for folks that, like, I think you're pretty well known in the space and whatnot, but give us a little bit of like serial entrepreneur, all that, like how you got to this space specifically and like why you chose to jump into embedded finance, BaaS, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, we'll stick to embedded finance today.
Okay. I think
that's the new term.
That's the term we're sticking with?
Yeah.
All right.
That's my third company. Doron and I, the founders at Unit, co-founded another company called Leverate back in Israel in 2007. And we spent a decade at that company. It was bootstrapped, but we were very, very young. We were 22 when we started that company. And it was fintech infrastructure. We had a bunch of pivots, and then we ended up building what became an online brokerage platform. So if you wanted to start a Robinhood or Schwab anywhere in the world, you would come to us with a license, and we would give you liquidity access, risk management tools, trading platforms, including UIs in 20-something languages, everything you need to run that business.
And did you know any of that before you started it?
Not like at all.
That was self-taught?
Nothing about finance, nothing about, I mean, I was an engineer. And
right.
I was keen to learn new business domains as much as I, and the more complex they were, the more fascinated I think we were.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a kid and you're starting your first company, nothing really feels like a barrier. Nothing is going to stop you from learning more and building more. And so we had this like superhuman pace at building that company. And we ended up growing it to about 160 people in 6 offices globally.
That's crazy.
I was initially managing engineering with Doron, my co-founder now. He was the CTO.
Yeah.
And then I moved to lead the product team. There was this new thing called
product
management.
Who
was CEO? See, there were two co-CEOs in the
beginning. Oh, okay.
And then one of them, Ron, went on to stay in the company. And then eventually another CEO came in and took the ship. So when I left, I was the last founder to leave. And I was in Hong Kong back then because I was leading Asia Pacific for the business. And then I took a sabbatical in 2017. Mm-hmm. So 2016, 2017 were the years that Doron and I, you know, took some time off. We both independently started other companies in fintech and failed independently.
In Israel, or were you here at this point?
I was in Hong Kong and he was in Israel.
Okay.
And I originally moved to Hong Kong to lead the Asia Pacific business. Before that, I led the product team at Leverage. So I had a pretty diverse journey over 10 years, but I exited when I was CEO at Asia, and then I kind of moved on to take a sabbatical, 1 year of, you know, 2 silent meditation retreats and traveled
the whole thing.
To 14 countries and worked with startups and you know, helped in San Francisco, in Shenzhen, China. It was a fun year. And so then we started our second companies. We failed in 2018 and we got together in 2019 to try to start what would later become Unit.
That's fascinating. How much, I mean, I'm not going to, you have a hard stop at 3:30, and I think by this point, the world knows what Unit is. So I'm not going to go too deep into that, but we can cover some pieces of it as we go. Mm-hmm. My first question is, how much of that learning experience from
the previous company, how similar does that feel, right? Because there's a whole, like, brokerage is a very different world from banking. So what is that like, even from when I met you in 2019, having phone calls and, like, you know, what's your sweep mechanism, all of these different things, right? And just like, mm-hmm. learn, what is that? Is that a one-to-one comparison? Is one different? Has one been harder to learn? What's that been like?
You know, I think as a founder, a good question to ask yourself is really what motivates you, like what makes you tick? And I think complex business domains is really, has always fascinated me and Doron. I think both trading, which is really a fast-paced, unforgiving industry. I mean, if systems go down for 10 or 12 seconds, people could be losing millions and people can then depend on you for not having facilitated trading, et cetera.
Right. So the trust is gone, right? And there's some overlap there.
Trust is extremely sensitive. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I would say the technical challenge in building a brokerage infrastructure was really incredible. And I was not, just to be clear, I was not the person solving the hardest technical challenges in the business. That was Doron. When he obsessed with making the trading engine send trades from click by the end user to the market in milliseconds, that was his entire focus and obsession for years. And he really perfected his understanding of how those systems work.
The intricacies of that, I mean, my depth is like having read Flash Boys, you know, like that's just like...
Yeah. So it wasn't quite as nanosecond dependent as Flash Boys is written. And it's a wonderful book. But it was more of the, you know, think about 100 different brokerages operating worldwide. Each one of them offers some subset of 4,000 instruments, indices, commodities, foreign exchange, stocks, and contracts for differences. And all these things need to fit into one system for the end user. They need to be tradable. Each one of them trades at a different schedule, different market dynamics, and you have to facilitate all of that. So at the point we left, we processed $100 billion a month in trading volume.
Oh, wow.
So that was in 2017. It about doubled since then.
These numbers eventually just start to not make sense, you know, like talking
abstract.
About, ACH processed, $7 trillion last month. And it's like, okay, I don't know. I know what that means, but I don't know what that means. I have no context around that.
I would say that the, what we saw in banking, trying to like master banking, is the business domain is complex. So if you go deep into ACH and all of the different return codes and timings and stuff that is written in the details of ACH, there's a lot to learn. But if you take a step away from like this ecosystem, and if I have to describe the complexity of trading versus the banking ecosystem, I would say trading is about 5 or 10x in just in terms of the technical nuance.
Really?
What did make Unit a really hard company to build was the unforgiving nature of banking regulations and the changing landscape of banking regulations in the US in the last few years, and also the intricacies of banking and lending as they, you know, apply differently to different audiences. So I would say we had to solve quite a few technical challenges, but the size of those challenges was really not as big as trading. I think the moving ecosystem is what makes, you know, banking as a service or embedded finance more interesting.
So going back to like the time that you and Doron had just ideating, right? Back in, you said 2019 led to Unit. What was the founding? I know you're big on jobs to be done and whatnot. So what was kind of like the founding thesis that you were solving? Well, we'll start there. And then my next question is like, and how has that changed? Mm-hmm. But what was it initially?
So the basic insight that we try to share in our seed deck and with people that spend time with us and also banks that we spoke to was that the fintech world is changing shape. The first wave of fintech innovation that we call Fintech 1.0 was companies like Chime and Venmo and Lending Club. And their only focus was trying to do what the incumbents do, but better, faster, cheaper.
Sure.
So their definition of success was, if we can take 20 or 30% from JP Morgan in the course of the next decade and do it just for our product, it would be very successful. So that was the old wave of fintech companies that we saw as somewhat successful at the time.
Yeah, not 20, 30%, maybe 2 or 3.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By today, I think people reduce their ambitions and things have changed.
Yeah.
Many of these companies, by the way, that were on pretty good trajectory have then, you know, got derailed. So that's something we can also spend time talking about.
But are you talking neobanks or which kind of companies?
Neobanks and, you know, neobanks that were maybe more promising 3-4 years ago than they are today.
Yeah.
Even Affirm and Robinhood, companies that try to take a bite from the bigger financial services pie, arguably to, you know, 80, 90% hits for to their ambitions and, mm-hmm. and scale and stock price. And I'm not here to talk about, you know, topical and timely stock prices. I'm here to talk about the shape of innovation that took place then versus what it was becoming.
Yeah.
So,
and everything you've named, though, has the overarching thing of highly regulated and has been derailed as a result of either policy or regulation for the most part, right? That gets a, like, if you talk about, I mean, it's less specific when you're talking about Chime and whatnot, and you're talking, but Robinhood, I mean, yes. regulatory, like across the board, it seems like the, it's interesting, like the classical makeup of an Israeli founding team, like makes so much sense in that trading world, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a no, that's like, yes, that's who I'm going to invest mm-hmm. in. But like knowing you, that does translate over here, but it is interesting the way that the technical decreases but the complexity increases right. in some other ways.
Because of regulation and just the yeah. moving environment.
Right.
Yeah. I would say that I think the killer for FinTech 1.0 companies was not regulation as much as it was customer acquisition cost.
Yes.
The success of Apple in banking and credit cards is a result of a really precious brand as well as unbeatable distribution. And yep. when Amazon becomes successful in financial services, we can say the same to Amazon. So I think the killer of most companies and potentially the biggest headwinds in front of the existing successful companies like mm-hmm. Robinhood and Chime is that it got very expensive to grow. And it wasn't the case when they started. In the beginning, there was some arbitrage that they had,
yeah.
marketing arbitrage as well as user experience arbitrage. Enough companies have caught up with them to make their user experience arbitrage somewhat diluted, and the marketing costs have just skyrocketed. So I think today, the incumbents are fighting more fiercely for end customers, and those companies are struggling to grow as much as they did, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Of course, regulation played a role in the headwinds, but I can actually argue that the bigger you are, the less vulnerable you are to changing regulations. It's the companies that are, you know, 10th to 100th place that in that wave of innovation that suffered, I think, the most because they didn't have the scale and they didn't have the cost structure to compete.
Yeah, definitely.
And capital, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, the capital, the interest rate environment in general, macroeconomy is the other side of it, right? Like, there's a certain amount of, like, when money is available.
Was it cheap? Yeah. And, yeah, it was easy to finance acquisition, user acquisition, and now it's just a very, very different dynamic.
Yeah, okay, so.
So that was first wave.
Founding thesis, yes. First wave.
So what we saw at the time that was starting, and it actually became much more pronounced faster than we thought, was that a new wave of companies were entering financial services. And these were not companies that you or I would think of as fintech companies. Their DNA was not purely fintech. It was right. more of a software dynamic. So we saw companies like Toast in the point of sale systems getting into lending. We saw companies like Gusto in payroll getting into wallets. We saw companies like Shopify and Uber and Lyft facilitating their money movement or payout capabilities to actually keep funds in-house
yep.
and give wallets and bank accounts to people. And we thought that this was actually a very, very big piece of news for fintech. We thought that this trend was A, just starting, B, much more powerful potentially than the old Chimes and Robinhoods, and 3, did not have the tool set. The tooling that was available to these companies was still old tooling. So you had to build Uber Money almost as if you've built Chime from scratch. That was the whole thesis. You've had to choose a sponsor bank, which you do today still, but then you had to choose a processor, a card printer, fraud solution, an identity solution, infosec solutions, and all sorts of other tools and systems to facilitate what was a basic wallet.
Yeah, and you had to stitch them all together and make them work correctly.
Exactly. Like, so you had to cobble them together. The people in your organization needed to develop opinions on how to do it effectively
yep.
and how to do it compliantly. And your bank partners needed to monitor you the whole time, which was your job as much as it was theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So companies like Uber Money or initiatives like Uber Money were built in a new era, but with all tooling. And we thought if this wave is going to be 10 times bigger in the number of challengers, if FinTech 2.0 is really going to live up to the expectations, and if we are right about these companies having natural advantages in data, distribution, software, trust. I mean, think about all these companies, Gusto, Shopify, Lyft, Toast, mm-hmm. Uber, they're all set up to really succeed in financial services. And we're seeing this. We're seeing this now more than ever. But back in the day, it was like, there's going to be more of them. They're going to be much more powerful than the Chimes and Venmos because they actually have flywheels that they've been spinning for a decade plus.
Yep.
And they need better tooling to build on. So what we've built was basically a platform that allows banks to sit on one side and provide direct relationships to those companies that build on them. And on the other hand, allow those companies to get a Stripe-like experience. So for an Uber Money to exist in 2024, it wouldn't take more than meeting a partner bank that uses the Unit platform,
yep.
Making an API call to identify a driver, making an API call to then open an account for that driver, assuming they're approved, making an API call to issue a card, or maybe five API calls to issue different cards,
yep.
Funding their account and allowing them to pay their bills, and basically building the front end. There's more innovation that we are now tackling on the front end side. There's a lot of boilerplate kind of UI that people have built over the years that we want to make available off the shelf. But what we have done was basically package it all up in a way that banks and tech companies can connect much more effectively.
Yeah. I mean, if you were paying attention back in those days and you look at like Q2 Open or whatever the fuck they're called now, Helium? Yeah. Helix. Helix. Yeah. They're not floating into the sky in the same way. And their work with Starbucks. Like, to me, that was like the canary in the coal mine about the, like, mm-hmm. that was the validating piece of this industry.
Correct.
Having a reason to exist, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, it's fascinating.
I'm not aware that Starbucks was built specifically on them, but...
It wasn't built on them necessarily, but I think they were, at that point, the middleware provider, and it was, I would describe, back in that day, mm-hmm. as a very indirect relationship, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was because the balances were so big. I mean, that is like... If you look at it, it's like the biggest community bank in the US or something, or like one of the smallest mega banks, or mm-hmm. however you want to measure it. So it was distributed across all these banks just mm-hmm. because of the broker deposit rules and everything else. But like we were back when I was at MBKC, we weren't really like competing for the business, but we were aware of it and had it as like this, you know, kind of like shining totem on a hill of like, oh man, one day maybe, you know, we could grow the balance sheet enough and be a well-known enough bank that we could work with them. Mm-hmm. And that always got me thinking about what this could be. And so one of the terms I just used is indirect. Mm-hmm. How did you make that decision early on? Like what, because none of the I don't know if I want to say that regulatory clarity totally exists mm-hmm. at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't think it does, but there was none at mm-hmm. that point, right? Yeah. Like it was just like, I don't know, it's time for yearly examination and we'll see what happens, mm-hmm. you know? So how did you kind of peel back layers and make the decision to be direct?
Yeah. So let me maybe take a step back and explain what we understand is the overall expectation of these partnerships.
Yeah.
Between a bank and a Starbucks or a bank and a Toast.
Mm-hmm. Without a middleware provider?
Let's assume that it might have value to add, but let's just ask the basic question. What makes these partnerships safe? And the answer is that the roles and responsibilities need to be extremely clear between the bank and the tech company. So if you look at Chime was actually built as a non-bank on top of partner banks, right? They have multiple partner banks and
yep.
they are using some, you know, different pieces of processing and card printing, and they have all these vendors that they've cobbled together. But and these pieces help the bank or could help the bank. But the basic expectation, regardless of who's involved, is that the roles and responsibilities are clear. And in the old days, what regulator looked at as program management, the act of distributing financial services on behalf of a bank and owning a bunch of different responsibilities, clear responsibilities, I think is changing shape these days, or could be redesigned in helpful ways. So when we started the company, one of the really basic questions we had to look at was, do we want to mandate that there is a legal line of sight between the bank and the client? Do they need to come into direct legal relationships? It wasn't trivial that the answer needed to be yes, because different companies were operating in different ways back then, and still do. By the way, there are companies that don't believe in that line of sight between the bank and the client, and Unit decided to take a different turn. I don't take credit for that responsibility or that decision. It was something that the outside counsel, Alex Acree, who is now our chief legal officer. Shout out to Alex. He's the best. But he encouraged it because he saw that as something more future-proof. So that was one design decision that really reinforced that we believe in these direct relationships between the banks and the clients. Another decision that I think later contributed to our how much value we can add was that as opposed to other companies that try to take over just the card issuing or just the ledgering or just the card printing or just the identity.
Yeah.
We really had the ambition to bring it all together. And we did it because we thought that something better should exist. We didn't actually think that the next 500 fintech builders in fintech 2.0 were motivated to shop for 20 different vendors and cobble them all together. So we built something that was comprehensive and basically had all this relationship between the bank and the tech company under one system. And that was a good decision because later when the need for oversight became much more acute and pronounced, we could build that operating system to cover much more of the bank needs to automate and make us consistent. Now, there are things we've changed as far as directness or direct elements in this relationship. I can give one example. So we are now working on a set of changes to the unit dashboard that lets clients request limit changes in the dashboard. Today, what clients do is that they either go to think about a company like Roofstock. Roofstock serves landlords. Let's assume they launch with two programs, VIP and Standard. And each one of these two programs has different limits to their bank accounts.
Okay.
They want to change one of the programs to slightly higher limits. They've always had to go to the bank either through a form that Unit asks them to fill or directly to the bank and ask for that limit change.
Yeah, have four calls, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah, they need to explain why make that change because it opens up new surface areas and the bank needs to explain it, document it, and approve it. And then apply it to the system, mm-hmm. which Unit enforces limits on the bank's behalf. But now we're transitioning into a world where limit changes can be requested by the client in the dashboard, and the bank can see a notification on the spot, and they can see the reasoning, and they can approve or deny. And then once they approve or deny, the system applies this behavior automatically, and everything is audit logged. That's an example for when Unit used to facilitate a concierge data exchange or context sharing between the bank and the client sometimes. And today we no longer see the need to. We want to encourage more directness in these relationships. I can probably give 5 or 6 other examples, but these small tweaks in the day-to-day communications in the sales process are what we are now working on deepening, because the expectation is that the banks know the clients well and the clients know the banks well.
Yeah. So this piece you recently wrote about directness, right? I think the thing for me about it is, in 2019, 2020, you were an early stage startup.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you were all the way direct or all the way indirect, mm-hmm. you were figuring it out. That's my perspective, right?
We made some key decisions on things like contracting.
Yeah, but
in other elements of our operations were not so rigid or not so strict, I would say.
Yeah.
Today, we mandate many more things, yes.
And
the messaging evolved and how we think of ourselves has evolved.
Right.
Another credit to Alex is that, you know, in financial services, definitions matter a lot.
Yeah.
I'm an engineer by background. We're trying to be strict about definitions. But if you look at some of the early copies of our website, we have said things that are more full maybe than the full suite of services that we designed over time, or maybe the banks were approving things, but it seemed like Unit was owning these things. We've refined our messaging and we became a lot more nuanced and precise in our definitions.
Yeah. I mean, when you're building a piece of software that is inherently designed to create efficiencies and create new products and create a whole new world that mm-hmm. didn't necessarily exist before, like, it wasn't like there was some kind of like rule book that was like, hey, here you go, here's what to do. To this day, regulators still will not provide you with a rule book.
Correct.
So this idea that you were indirect or direct or whatever it is, like, I think it's kind of not the point, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, the where you're getting to today and the level of compliance and kind of, you know, who's on the platform, who's off the platform, and you reorienting around the clarity of the bank as the customer, I mean, it seems like some of it truly is UX related, like you said, right? It's the idea that somebody would do something in the dashboard versus go direct to the bank is like the logical thing. If you take the OCC out of it, mm-hmm. is do it in the dashboard,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that's the engineer. That's the natural thing. Yeah,
it's efficient. Is tracked.
Yeah,
it's something that is audited.
Yeah,
yeah. And so it makes sense for all parties.
It makes sense for all parties, and it's also like kind of the thesis around RegTech. Right? Like the thesis of RegTech is like, here's a piece of software to sit in between the things so that you can communicate about the things, have transparency.
Correct.
Right. And now we're getting to a point that I find interesting, if not ironic, but definitely interesting, where you're because of regulation, removing some of the obvious efficiencies that could exist, mm-hmm. but doing it for the right reasons.
Correct. Creating speed bumps that make the ecosystem live up to the expectations of stakeholders.
Right.
I would say that the, again, I said that the context, the concept of a program manager needs to be potentially challenged because, again, you look at how Chime operated in the early days.
Let's go back one. Back when I was at MBKC, this was one of the conversations we would have all the time, right? It was, if a brand was coming to us or a banking as a service embedded finance provider was coming to us, the question was always, well, the first question was, who's going to be the program manager? Mm-hmm. And that was just a canary in the coal mine question of, do you know what program management is? Mm-hmm. And still to this day, I think that a lot of folks in the industry don't. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth defining is what I'm driving towards. Yeah. So can you define program management and then we'll go from there?
Yeah. So again, let me talk about the pre-infrastructure days. Let's talk, you know, 10 years ago when companies like Galileo might have existed and a Chime is now getting built and they need to make all these decisions.
Right.
There are so many different surface areas that relate to regulatory expectations that banks have. Those surface areas start with identity and making sure that each user is identity checked and fraud checked. And there is a lot of nuances to that, but that's one bucket. Then there is the stage of, you know, you move money on their behalf. You need to enforce limits. You need to measure fraud and report it back to the bank. End users might have disputes that they're initiating or complaints that they're submitting in different channels, and you need to keep track of them. You need to distribute the statements to them. You need to, of course, do money laundering prevention activities in the background. You need to make sure that the fees are being assessed in the right ways. You need to make sure that reconciliation, which is what the end users, what the Chime and what the bank see and the Fed potentially, all match each other. You need to be, you know, processing according to network rules. There's so many different things you had to do as a party to the bank, a third party to the bank.
Right.
And our thinking as of 2024, and it's been evolving for the last couple of years, is that there's a chance, because of technology, because of infrastructure, there's a chance to reconsider how those responsibilities are being split between the bank, the client, and potentially a useful piece of technology that sits in the middle. I'll make one easy example, and then I'll go on to another more nuanced one. An easy example is that I don't think anyone is interested in letting 100 fintech companies generate statements from scratch. There's lending statements, deposit statements.
Right.
Yeah, they're going to be of 99 different degrees of quality.
Yeah,
and it's anyone's guess. You know, who is going to be better or worse at that? It is helpful if there's one central system that knows how to generate statements according to bank rules, or even calculate interest and reward interest and split revenues according to the bank's rules. It's visible to the bank. It's visible to the client, and clients can download statements at the end of the month PDF, HTML, English, Spanish, other languages. So I think this is a relatively non-controversial argument that there is some gain to be had by putting some useful piece of technology in between the 100 fintechs that sit here and the banks that serve them on the other side.
I think everything you just described is like, well, we need a software solution for this.
Correct.
Yeah, makes sense.
Let me describe something that might be slightly more challenging, but I still believe in it. If banks pay interest to end users and this interest exceeds $10 for a calendar year, you need to produce 1099 INT forms.
It's one of the craziest things I ever learned at the bank.
And send them to all the users one by one.
Wild.
And truth is, if you're a bank today that has 100 programs or 50 programs or 20 programs, each one of them individually needs to query the database, you know, identify a mail solution and an email solution that would then send notices to the end users, as well as file with the IRS directly. And all of this is being done by 20 different companies in 20 different ways. I would like to argue that even though it's a operational task that involves printing paper and sending it to people over mail, it is useful for a piece of technology to do all of this and enforce it at a bank level and without any room for error. And if there are slight errors, they can be fixed, but they're uniformly applied to all the programs.
Is that a controversial take?
No, but I'll give you another one, and I'm increasing.
Okay,
level.
It's getting spicier and spicier. Let's go.
So disputes. All right. Disputes is another source of regulatory scrutiny. People want to make sure that there is a regulations that relate to electronic transfer acts, and it's known as Reg E for people that understand banking well. People like you and I, or even small businesses, need to have the ability to file a dispute for card or ACH transactions. After they happen, if we believe that they were unauthorized or otherwise we want to challenge. The institutions that issue cards and move money need to respond to those disputes within regulatory timelines, and there are a bunch of rules about provisional credit, final credit, investigation timelines, and you know, again, if you look at how 20 different companies that work with the same banks have implemented this historically, they all need to hire someone that understands disputes. They all need to manage those disputes in a compliant way, and they all need to report back to the bank, either by mail or a piece of paper or Excel, what happened to some subset or all of their disputes. And someone in the bank needs to then understand there are 20 different sources of disputes, and it's very hard. What we've decided to do, and this is the operational aspect of Unit, not just the technical aspect, we stood up a call center that Visa operates, and Visa picks up the phone whenever someone from the end user audience calls. They pick up the phone, they take the dispute, they manage the life cycle of the dispute end to end. And from the bank's perspective, in the dashboard, at the end of every day, they have a full list of disputes with their stage, amount, program, and status and recent developments. And all of that is just in one dashboard. And again, this is a step away from 20 different programs managing their own disputes in their own ways. We believe it's safer for the ecosystem. It's more economic and it's safer because we took something that was done in a distributed manner and we just centralized it in one place. And again, that's a piece of innovation that we would like to pose is helpful for the banks as well as for the fintechs.
So what's the argument to the other side? Am I just not enough of a Luddite to understand what the other side of this would be in terms of the pushback?
No, I think that there is a elevating level of concern with other aspects. I'll give you one example. In the old days, it used to be very common for 20 different chimes to have their own anti-money laundering practices.
Sure.
Head of AML, yep. Analysts that then work transactions and customer monitoring and basically make all the decisions and report to the bank what seems like suspicious activity. This is very true, very normal as of 10 years ago, also 5 years ago. Now there is an increasing level of expectation that banks themselves own this type of activities or a subset, the more sensitive types of activities. And as it's becoming clear, there is a need or request from banks to own those activities. So the technology now makes it easier. So the existence of platforms like Unit can help banks ingest all the transactions across all the programs in real time if they want to, and make them flow into one central engine that the bank might use in their traditional branch activities. And the same rules that apply to people that walk into branches might apply to other programs, or the banks may take a more nuanced and more program-level approach to these transactions. But there is an evolving set of expectations that banks own more of that. It's not uniform, it's not clear-cut, but it's something that we're watching along with others in the ecosystem, and we're implementing with partner banks. And so this is an example for a type of activity that you can debate. Should it be centralized? I think it should be centralized regardless of, is it Unit that owns it? Is the bank that owns it? From a headcount and procedure process standpoint. But I think it used to be less safe. The 20 different companies had their own 20 different activities. Now the tech allows for one entity to be the central processing point for all of that.
This episode is brought to you by Skipify. So what is this magical Skipify, this connected wallet thing that they've built? Well, imagine purchasing a product as a consumer with a merchant you've never actually shopped with before, and your credit card's already saved with them. Sounds scary, but it's not. You've never added this merchant before. Your shipping address is already there. How did they know? You're not sure, but you hit buy and your product is on the way. That's Skipify in the background. Skipify goes beyond what other digital wallets or one-click checkout products are doing. They've built direct integrations within the banks you already bank with. That's where the connected piece of the connected wallet comes from. So that step of adding or saving cards in the connected wallet is totally skipped. Get it? Skipify. Skipify is pre-populating card info and shipping details from the banks for consumers. They can even embed features like card offers, paying with points, or buy now, pay later options directly into the moment of checkout. It's better for the banks than Apple Pay, better conversion for the merchants, and better consumer experience for the actual shopper. If you aren't working with Skipify yet, you probably should be, or at the very least, go check them out.
So I have a theory around embedded finance where a lot of the quote unquote embedded finance providers are actually at the end of the day going to become two things, a regtech company.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the term light core really, because it feels like it's like replacing a Fiserv or something like that, but a light core.
Side core. Maybe?
Side core. Yeah. There you go. Side. Yeah. My side piece. Side
mm-hmm.
core.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things sounds exactly like what you just described.
Correct.
Right. Like the idea that, to your point, whether that I think it, there's a general agreement that the bank should own it, but the idea that there wouldn't be a piece of software that sits on top of, I mean, some pieces of software that were built in COBOL,
mm-hmm.
right, that could take in data, organize it, prioritize it,
mm-hmm.
right, and then allow you to function and work on it.
Correct.
Doesn't seem wild, friend. Like, that seems pretty fucking straightforward.
It is straightforward.
You know? Yeah. And, like, that's, I think that's the thing for me about a lot of this that's so interesting is, like, I feel like we spend a lot of time debating things that are pretty inherently rational or, like, just inherently straightforward.
I think there's a straw man sentiment in the space right now, which is some companies might be running wild and they don't, you know, maybe people assume that infrastructure companies don't have as much attention to compliance as they do. And so there is a just a wrong perception of how these things even behave on the technical level. I mean, if I describe Unit to any examiner or, you know, agency that cares to listen, or just a smart friend or someone that works at a bank, I'm really going to describe something that sounds like a core. And it is a core. I mean, it is a specialized core,
right,
that was made for digital activities. Some of our bank partners use this core as a means for to serve their own core customers unrelated to fintech.
Talk more about that, because I think there's this over assumption that, like, oh, they're working with, well, you're the only group that I can really think of this way, maybe Treasury Prime, I don't know, you're really the only one I can think of, but it's a piece of technology that, mm-hmm. even if you're not a sponsor bank, you can benefit from and use, right? Like, and the only, like, out, it, that makes you think of Alloy and Sardine.
Correct.
And all these others.
Correct.
Right? And that's why I say the RegTech thing. But also, to your point, the side core slash just layered core, like, you're a piece of software that a bank can use, and it doesn't matter if there's a Chime on the other side or a Airbnb on the other side.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, exactly. So our system is designed to allow the banks to launch multiple programs directly. One of their programs can be their own core customers. There are a couple of design elements that we need to factor in when that happens. Because there is no third party, the risk is inherently lower, because the bank itself is doing potentially branch signups and other kind of in-house activities. But essentially, it's a core system. I mean, Unit is just a Fiserv that is purpose-built for fintech. And Fiserv, for example, doesn't have strong opinions on identity. Fiserv doesn't have strong opinions on reserves, because banks don't usually care about reserves in their core activities. I'm talking about fraud reserves and other kind of sensitive things. Fiserv might not care about fee reports that apply to 10 different programs by program, because Fiserv doesn't speak the language of programs. So think about us as we think that the difference is big enough between a core system and a core system that's made for fintech to warrant building the second type as a specialized kind. And that's what Unit is, essentially. It's not mystical. The sentiment should not be that negative. We just think there is enough substance in what banks care about and what banks want to enforce and what banks need to stand up as baseline to warrant a standalone core that helps them serve any number of fintech programs and see them all in one place. That's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, when I was at NBKC, actually we did, I think, work on 3 or 4 different brands that we wanted to launch as a bank.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Finastra and mm-hmm. tried to have that conversation. It was basically like, okay, well, if you want like 3 more core instances, then you can absolutely do that. And it's like, wait, what? Like, so you're saying we're going to like quadruple our fixed costs? And you need to pay
for professional services to install each one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then let's pay Accenture $14 million to come in and tell us that we weren't wrong. Yeah, exactly. And it was like, I had so much faith in some of the things that we were working on. And then I come to find out that that's just not economically feasible at all. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think we get so stuck on this idea of sponsor banking, external group. And obviously that's like the main use case, but understanding that I think is really important in terms of like what this thing actually is. Mm-hmm. I'm curious for you, how much do you agree with, I mean, I know you kind of generally agree with like the, it's similar to a core. How much do you feel like the embedded finance space in general and Unit especially is going to move in a reg tech direction or already is?
I think there is a lot of, again, regulatory best practices baked into the systems already, and it's just getting better. The basic ways in which we incorporated RegTech into Unit is that, as an example, you can't possibly open an account for a person without feeding the details of that person through a workflow, an identity workflow. And if there is a flag that jumps and another document is required, the system is going to mandate that that document is provided and then potentially look at it and approve or deny that applicant. So a lot of the workflow that we have baked into Unit is enforcing things that the banks care about. Statements, again, are a very basic thing. And every first of the month, they're being produced for the previous month and the tech companies can distribute them. There are all sorts of things that are baked in from a compliance and regulatory standpoint. These things just get better over time. So things like fee reports per program or the health of the reserve accounts per programs or the overall amount of fraud per program or the overall amount of disputes per 10,000 users per program. Mm-hmm. All these things can eventually be bubbled up to the bank and give them a central dashboard. So I think this is one way in which we have baked compliance into the product. And again, there's always going to be a person in the loop. There's no world in which a new company wants to work with a bank and the bank doesn't get to meet them, doesn't get to know them, their business, their product, their founders, their business plans. We are going to continue to see that. But where can we enforce things that are valuable for both sides is the thing that we are asking ourselves. Another element in giving value to both sides and simplifying is that everything we've done around white label app and white label UI is good news both for the fintech and the bank. For the fintech, there is an easy way for them to stand up user interface that's compliant and has all the basic elements built in. For the bank, it's a good way to know that this fintech company is not going to be innovating in ways that can open up surface areas. So we are trying to build more helpful recipes and consistent workflows between the two sides that just get better over time. There's always going to be some form of, you know, asterisk or like residual risk that the bank has to monitor directly. Marketing materials, as an example, is still a relatively nascent thing in the automation world. The banks still want to be in full control over how these products are marketed and what are the specific properties of the products and terms. But I believe that over time, a lot of these things will become less manual work heavy and more automated.
Yeah, it is interesting the way that like every bank I've ever been inside of or every bank, community bank I've ever worked with that's on the sponsor banking side, mm-hmm. like has very clear, like you can only say FDIC here. You mm-hmm. can only, you know, things along those lines. It blows my mind how we still get to a point of people fucking that up. Mm-hmm. Like it truly confuses me and it makes me wonder where the disconnect is. Where do you think the disconnect is on something kind of that seems so simple?
I'm not a complete expert on the most specific and sure. recent guidance, but I would say that in the absence of centralized guidance, banks are in dialogue with their own regulatory stakeholders about what passes the bar, what meets the bar. So what we see in our ecosystem is that banks are coming up with their own guidelines for their programs. And they insist to continue to review marketing materials. And if there's an update that could come from someone in their stakeholder system, or maybe a consent order that was published for another bank, or something that came up more broadly in the ecosystem, they update how they think about it. But I wish there was a more centralized way to publish regulatory guidance that would then remove the question marks. Because I agree with you, these things should not be controversial. They should be technical. I mean, it should be as simple as following dispute timelines, right? It should be a clear cut.
Convoluted if-then statements.
Yeah. Exactly. It should be something very automatable.
Yeah. Completely. Yeah. So I think thinking about kind of where the industry is, I think a lot of the questionable actors are kind of out of it at this point. I think there's still maybe some, and there that Twitter can debate that. But for the most part, I think we've gotten to this point of here's the groups, maybe minus one or two, that are going to exist for at least like the next 5 years, 10 mm-hmm. years, whatever. When I was at NBKC, and that was 5 years ago now, it always felt to me like the regulatory conversations were very hindsight oriented, mm-hmm. right? You had a, felt like a, I know it was more than yearly, but it felt like a yearly examination. And then you would learn something from the yearly examination. There would never be much in between. And then you would implement those changes, and then we'll see you in a year, mm-hmm. right? That system, I think, happens because the data doesn't flow straight through the regulators, mm-hmm. things along those lines. Other companies are trying to solve that. And I think there's an argument that Unit could get involved mm-hmm. in that eventually, right? How much has that changed at all? Not in terms of really the reg, not in terms of like a compliance oversight schedule, but does it seem to you like the conversation between regulator and banker or regulator and technology company is increasing in cadence, or is it a, has that changed?
So anything that has to do with between examiners and banks is completely in the domain of their boardrooms and their engagements.
Totally, 100%. Drive towards, I think, is the not the like quantitative correct answer to this, but does it feel to you it like does. There's more conversation happening?
Yes, there does seem to be more conversation. I think that what we're seeing in the last year is obviously that the regulatory scrutiny has been dialed up meaningfully. There are consent orders, there is more action in this ecosystem, there are attempts to draw clear lines between companies that do it the right way, quote unquote, or the wrong way. I think there should be room for more nuanced discussion about what we're all trying to achieve. By the way, one thing I don't think people talk nearly enough about is, why are we here? I mean, we help power with our bank partners. Banking for construction companies, independent workers who work in logistics and manufacturing jobs, restaurants, nonprofits. The list is very, very long, and we're very proud of this work. And I think that there are two sets of stakeholders that are stated policy priorities in the US. One is end users. People need better access to the financial system. They need more competition in the financial system to serve them better. And the community banks is a second set of stakeholders that we believe should be empowered. And this ecosystem is a lifeline for them. For the end users, I have a strong belief that the more points of distribution we can build, and yes, of course, there are problems and surface areas, but the more thoughtfully we approach it, and the more we remember what the end objective is, which is to increase financial access and allow people to enjoy more abundance of financial services, more competition, the better off we will be. So I just think that this is something we don't talk nearly enough about. Unit is going to be taking the lead on sharing customer stories and user stories publicly. I have an old dream to start a social media channel and really tell people's small financial stories, like, you know, your neighbor or your barber or someone in your neighborhood that owns a coffee shop. How did they go about their finances? How do they finance the construction of their coffee shop? What do they use for point of sale? How do they pay their vendors? Is it check or ACH? How do they pay their employees? How does the person who works at the restaurant want to get paid? Like, I'm really curious about these types of stories. But I think it's something we should talk about more, because if we only talk about what's in front of us and the controversial kind of stories that come out, I think we will lose sight of something that is very, very important. And frankly, JP Morgan wants us all to lose sight of the really important things that can become possible if this ecosystem succeeds. Just my two cents.
No, I completely agree. I think that it's really interesting. So we started a new show at Money 2020 that hasn't launched yet, but the first question that we ask, it's like a YouTube show, is what does fintech mean to you? And we've asked it on a few episodes now, and Nicole Kasperson at this point is the only person that has answered with it impacts humans, mm-hmm. which, like, of course, that's Nicole. So obviously that's the direction she goes with it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's like, I was at Merrill Lynch and I saw a annuity salesperson come in the door and I saw our entire product sales mix shift as a result of understanding what percentage you can make on this instead of this. And I thought, how are you not a fiduciary? Like your broker, wait, you can be a broker dealer and a fiduciary and you can like take off the hat, put back on and not tell anybody. Like this is the most broken fucking system in the world. So I agree with you completely. And I think that we've almost gotten to a point of, I think we've complete, like to your point on 1.0 to 2.0, I think we've completed like a full fintech economic cycle, right? Where we've gone from like beginning to end. We've had interest rates do the whole thing. We've had the full economy do the whole thing. We've seen companies do the whole thing. And now I think we're coming back to a point where the why will actually matter again over the next year or two. And especially coming up on an election, I think that people get a lot more associated with their why a little bit more if they're paying attention at all. So I agree completely, but I think it's, this is one of the, I was talking to Trevor Tanifam from FS Vector and we were actually, we were talking about the news and talking about kind of what's, you know, consent orders and things along those lines. And the thing we kept coming to was like, if it bleeds, it leads. Right. And consent orders are not great and enforcement actions are not great, but it's not shutting down of a bank. It's not like, you know, it's not what happened to SVB. Like SVB in its own right just took the wrong interest rate risk and look at where we got, right? So I think we're, anyway, I think point being we're coming back to a place where the why will matter and we're coming back to a place where like consumer companies may just start to get started again, right? Which is kind of interesting. But there's also the dynamic of like, well, maybe the next like even potentially more meaningful Chime is getting built right now. And then talking about the Airbnbs of the world, from your perspective, which of those is more interesting in like the next wave of fintech, not even embedded finance, just fintech? Like, do you think that an Uber Money, to your point, versus, you know, the Chime 4.0 or whatever it is, like which one gets you more excited?
We only have one clear answer to this question, which is the embedded finance, non-fintech flavor of fintech. So the Airbnbs, not the Chimes. And this answer is because I think that the trends we mentioned, the cost of acquisition and just the difficulty to compete in financial services today is just getting really, really big. And the future of financial services, I think, because of the cost of the tragedy of the cost of acquisition in financial services and the low margin is going to be that it's only the Airbnbs and Ubers and Shopify's and Toasts of the world that have the biggest chance. And I'm not saying this only because they have the distribution advantage. I mean, having 90,000 restaurants in your at your fingertips and, you know, having them love you really helps. But it's also like the amount of software and data and trust and just like distribution is one component. There's a flywheel that keeps spinning. I mean, Toast just gets better and better as a company to their restaurants. And there are more companies like them that nobody's heard about because they're not public and celebrated, but are now getting into financial services. So we have a strong view that nobody is starting the next Chime. Nobody is funding the next Chime. It could be that there are miracles. And I wish the US economy to like see more of these entrants in the next 5 years. But the market dynamics, I mean, the pure commercial and economic dynamics around these companies are becoming untenable. And it's only the companies, I mean, Apple is probably the one consumer brand that everybody's betting on because it's such an extreme example of their advantages.
But even then, like the financial aspect of that, like Goldman ran away.
Correct.
You know?
So yeah, I mean, these, the distribution is just one part of the equation.
Right.
There's also something to be said for vertical versus horizontal use cases. Apple is definitely a kind of wide horizontal mass public use case.
Yeah.
I have a bigger belief in customers that are in points of distribution that have a more strong take on who their users are. Restaurants, e-commerce businesses, construction companies, nonprofits, independent workers that work in a specific industry. The more specific you are, I think the bigger the chance you will have to build meaningful financial relationships with these people. And to me, if you look 10 years forward, if you, I mean, assuming that this ecosystem lives up to the expectations and really makes a dent in the financial world in the US, I can see a world in which there are 10,000 points of distribution for financial services. These 10,000 companies are going to be companies that own 0.1% or 0.2% of the economies each, but they're really good at it. I mean, there's no reason that a Toast would not continue to be successful in financial services. And there is no reason that Procore won't be that for construction companies.
Yep.
So My bet is that we will see a fragmentation of the points of distribution and that companies will learn how to specialize. The Apples of the world are going to remain successful. They're going to be the anomaly. They're going to be the one company that perhaps gives JP Morgan a run for its money, but not many companies are going to look like that. And this is why we don't believe that the chimes are tenable in 2024.
Yeah. I agree with everything you just said, but Christ, I hope for a miracle. Like, I mean, it's like the more value that I kind of like JPM mm-hmm. in my own way. And I'm not going to say anything about SETI, but I kind of like JPM. But the idea that they are running as far away from everyone else as they are is mm-hmm. like scary. I mean, it's wild how well they're doing compared to the rest of the pack yes. and like the value accruing up there. Like, you kind of get to a point where you're like, I don't know if Apple could compete even. I mean, yeah, financial
yeah,
you know, I think reserves of Zeus, but like...
One of the other reasons I'm more bearish on consumer use cases is that the user-facing feature set is pretty small. I mean, yeah. you and I need to pay our rent. Yeah. We need to use our cards in a restaurant. We need to move money to friends and family sometimes, but we don't have vast financial needs and we definitely don't have fancy workflows in our lives. I mean, the fancier workflow I have in my life is that I go to Schwab once a month and I send money to my landlady. Like that's yeah. literally the one thing that I wish I could automate. But think about a business point of view, right? Think about a restaurant, construction company,
payroll
nonprofit.
Alone is more complex These things, than everything
exactly,
you just said.
Exactly. And 100%. Also like think about spaces where, you know, construction, unique cash flows, unique payment cycles, more opportunity to bridge and provide financing. Think about landlords. They have their rent collection and they have deposit taking, deposit releasing, bill pay. When you're facilitating all of that for them, the value you give in automation is just massive. So do I think JP Morgan is going to maintain its consumer footprint in 10 years? Yes. They will be challenged by the biggest tech companies because they have the footprint, the consumer footprint to challenge them. But I don't think anyone else will give JP Morgan a run for its money. I do think that in business banking, I mean, think about companies that help you form your LLC. Mm-hmm. These days, most of them or many of them give you a bank account built into that formation stage.
Yeah.
And why would any LLC then walk into the local Citi or JP Morgan branch if they can get their online bank account on the spot, right? So I think it's the business side that will cause what I think of as the, you know, how people say retail apocalypse mm-hmm. that played out because of Amazon. And yeah. then everybody woke up yeah. overnight and were yeah. like, oh man,
yeah.
like Uh-oh. The ecosystem is Amazon's and everybody's like going out of business. I think the same thing will happen slowly and then overnight in the financial services ecosystem. And it will be mostly the businesses that are going to cause these shifts in behavior. Because again, you and I are going to have the same financial needs more or less in 10 years.
Yeah.
So just to our two cents.
No, I'm sure you know who Naval Ravikant is and his mm-hmm. kind of like theory around everybody should be a business, right? Mm-hmm. And like the idea that we should all, like there should be...
Your personal identity is your
yeah,
brand. And
yeah, there should be however many billion businesses in the world and we should all be entrepreneurs and solopreneurs and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, when you think about Mercury, Row, what, you know, whatever it is, like the excitement around something like that or the excitement around, you know, like this year, I've randomly started digging into John Deere Bank. Have mm-hmm. you dug into them at all?
No.
I mean, it's what it sounds like. It's John Deere has a bank. You know, it's like there's a lot of...
They own a bank charter?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's vertically integrated and really exists so that they can do lending on the very, very expensive equipment that they have to provide to farmers, yeah. right? So straightforward, like there's no nuance there. It's just like, that makes sense. Let's vertically integrate it because we know our customer, mm-hmm. right? And because we've figured out that like, there's a lot of money to make if we vertically integrate. Mm-hmm. And I think that alone, like, you know, farming is going in an interesting direction, but like that alone is an argument for exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So we're almost an hour in and I haven't gotten to spend time with you in a while. And listening to you talk, I'm curious, and like listening to you talk, knowing what, you know, just the regulatory world is like, what it's like to be, not knowing what it's like to be a CEO in embedded finance, but having some sense of it not being the easiest thing in the world, especially right now. Mm-hmm. What has it been like emotionally for you as a CEO and I guess for Duran too? I mean, not that you can really speak for him, but like, what has it been like kind of going through some of these ups and downs? Like, how have you kind of maintained your sanity in all of this, because you have to learn, you have to execute, and then you have to learn again, and then somehow you have to execute while you're learning, and just so on and so forth, and then run everything else that we just talked about, mm-hmm. right? So not to overwhelm you with all the things in your life you weren't thinking about at the moment, but...
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just like thinking about how do I organize the answer? I think that leading in a dynamic field is a challenge. Mm-hmm. Leading a growing company or a meaningfully sizable group of people is a challenge.
How many people is unit now?
160.
That's meaningful.
It is meaningful.
For sure.
Yeah. And it is also an invitation to practice patience, which not everybody can afford. I mean, if you have a smaller balance sheet, or if you're a younger company, or if you have any runway considerations that yeah. force you to take action or rethink your course, there are some companies that are forced to do that, and I think it's healthy for them. We've been fortunate to afford patience. Patience is not one of my personal strong suits.
I would not describe you as patient personally. No.
And no. but it is helpful to remember that we're building for the long term. It's helpful to remind our team that we're building for the long term. It's helpful to take some historical perspective and also have some regulatory empathy. I mean, what's happening now in this ecosystem is a result of people trying to carefully study how the ecosystem works and trying to define what good looks like
yeah.
for the next 10 years. You can believe in one of two things. You can believe that this ecosystem is going to be permanently slowed down and stopped, and that innovation in the US is going to have no room in financial services. Or you can believe that this is a slowdown that can then include some signal or information on how to move forward safely and scalably. And I still believe strongly in the latter. So I believe in it myself. I talk to our team in those terms. We're trying to take the actions that position us well for the next 10 years. Again, not every company can afford it in terms of their balance sheet and runway and how they think about the future. But, you know, I'm practicing patience. I'm taking good care of myself. It hasn't been easy to deal with the dynamism in the space right now, but we're trying to keep our eyes on the ball. And the ball is, we have a big role to play in financial access. We have a big role to play. Infrastructure is a problem that I've really enjoyed working on yeah. from a young age. I'm really fascinated by the idea that you can build one piece of technology and really elevate standards for millions of individuals and businesses. And to stay on that course, we have a lot to prove as a company. And I think that everything we're doing now is in service of that long-term mission and having the personal energy bar to keep going and having the company stamina to keep going. And obviously financials play a role in making sure you have that stamina. So I believe in the long-term. It has been a balancing act. Learning how to communicate with our team, learning how to communicate with our banks, our customers. I mean, going to banks and reassuring them yeah. that we are going to respect every single risk management decision they make for good. I mean, we take it for granted that we know it, but I am having these conversations with all of our bank partners because I want people to remember that we're building a business for 20 years. And banks need to take note and need to treat us like partners that can help position them well for the next 20 years and not as a company that tries to like grow really fast and then does things in an unhealthy way.
Yeah. The grow fast and break things, you know, that's
doesn't work in finance.
Doesn't work in fintech. It took us 10 years to figure it out, but we figured it out.
Yeah. And the abundance of capital, I think, was a twisting factor, right? Yeah. In this ecosystem.
I think you guys were, I think there's always different advice around it, but the take the money when you can get it thing, like, I'm really glad you guys did that.
Thank you. We got lucky. I'm not going to take any credit or attribute this to being smart. I would say we have smart investors. We built a strong momentum by hopefully executing decently well for some years. And now I'm very, very happy that we have the capital and the team to navigate from here and that we can afford the patience. And by the way, in terms of business trajectory, the last two quarters were the strongest quarters in sales in the history of Unit. We have bigger and bigger names. So the number of deals that we can sign, especially with younger companies, is limited by bank capacity. The true situation in fintech right now is that all banks have capacity constraints. So everyone is trying to focus on the more scalable, more successful programs. We've signed some of the biggest customers to date. We are launching some of our biggest customers to date. We're proud of the names we're powering, and some of them are not public, but we see the momentum. I just think that we have a focus right now, which is bigger deals, and so do our bank partners. And for our ecosystem to come out of it, I think it will take some more time and some more regulatory clarity. But by business trends, we're doing well. I think the biggest, like the most, the punishment that I think is unfortunate is that younger companies are being challenged right now when they want to build financial services. It used to be possible.
Now is how it feels, right? Like if you raise $3-5 million in a seed round,
very hard. Banks are more skeptical about your financial standing. They're more skeptical about your ability to scale. And by the way, we've seen incredible teams that were initially funded this amount growing to be meaningful customers of Unit and, you know, meaningful fintech companies. There's an annoying chicken and egg situation where there's a gate that you can't enter through. You used to be able to get through the gate. Now you can't. And it makes our ecosystem a little bit more unfair to younger companies. And I think there are ways to de-risk the system and allow them to innovate. Yeah. But the situation right now, the clouds in the regulatory ecosystem force banks to be more prudent and more picky with who they choose to work with and who they choose to keep working with.
Which I agree with you. It is unfortunate. And like some of when I was running the accelerator at MBKC, like some of the companies that I just forced in there, that we didn't even end up partnering with a number of them because they were so early on. But it was like the amazing founder that raised $500K and wanted to peel back one layer, you know, of the risk and then go from there. And like just that ability has fallen by the wayside. And that's not going to be a thing that will exist, I think, in the next 5 or so years. But then where I just came from, I was having a conversation with somebody about what it takes to create a de novo chartered bank, right? Mm-hmm. And if you draw that as a corollary and you think about what it actually is required to start a new bank, and then you think about the idea that we're complaining, fetching, call it what you want, but like talking.
But it's still accessible.
Yeah.
Still available to companies. Yeah.
It's comparatively.
Correct.
Right? Like
relative to even 5 years ago, it's a very, very accessible ecosystem. But I wish it was a bit more. And I think it will be over time. I mean, one of the things that I think about is how do you allow smaller companies that are more vertical in nature to access the ecosystem? I mean, if you had a compelling pitch that you can be the next Chime in, you know, 2019, you would get accepted to work with a bank.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, not so much. Today, hardly at all. But I do want to give companies that serve production companies or construction companies or, you know, 150 nonprofits the chance to build. And they don't represent a massive number of accounts. They represent a deeper financial relationship.
Yeah.
And we need to find ways to make this viable for the bank that supports them. And in today's ecosystem, most banks have this calculus when they say, oh, there's a company here that can bring on 150 nonprofits, but it's not such a large number of accounts, and therefore I can't support them. And I this is a pattern that I think we should solve for collectively as an ecosystem, because this is going to be the main frontier of innovation in financial services, these vertical use cases that don't seem huge at first. But Toast also got started as a relatively small business that serves know, restaurants in one city.
Yeah. Well, we have to figure out the FBO rules if that's going to function at all.
Do you want to go into this rabbit hole?
No, I don't. I was thinking, I was like, what am I going to say next? FBO is about to come out of my mouth. This is a slippery fucking slope. Let's not do it. We don't have time for all that. We don't have time for all that. What time is it? I think the closing question before plug all the things. There's classical kind of like advice associated with being CEO of certain kinds of companies, right? Which is like, put on the blinders and just build, right? You do not have that luxury. I don't think anybody in your seat that is doing anything close to a unit or, you know, even the Chimes of the, none of these, if you're in finance, you don't get to have the blinders on, right? So you have to build, communicate internally, as you said.
Externally
as well.
You have a close ecosystem around you,
yeah.
Partners and vendors and our bank customers and our clients.
You have to read a lot, I'm sure, or tell Alex to read and then come back and tell you what he read. Mm-hmm. But you have to interpret it and believe in it strongly.
Correct.
The amount of context that you have to develop seems sizable. And like, no, I mean, man, we had a conversation back in 2019 about deposit sweep networks and you were like, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And like today you're sure, you know, like it's, things have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my question is kind of for myself and kind of for the audience, which is how do you do that? I know you're a very smart individual and that is part of the answer, but like, how do you create all of this context? Is there anything about the way that you structure your day? Is there anything about the way that you've kind of learned to function inside of this specific industry that's like taking all of that in without completely overwhelming yourself?
Mm-hmm. I'll confess that I pretty much lost the ability to read professional material outside of work. Like that's my main confession. When I read books, I read other kinds of books. They could be about biology or they could be about history.
Yeah.
But I don't seek out these types of reads outside of work. I do get a meaningful, you know, drinking from the fire hose every day. I don't think I know everything in our business. I think I'm technical and inclined to learn the smaller details of many things. I think we have a culture that I'm very, very proud of. I mean, the technical orientation of even the legal and compliance leadership at Unit is deep. People go deep. People don't evade the small details. And if there's one cultural win that we have that I'm very proud of collectively, is that we encouraged a culture of deep attention to detail. So by no means I'm an expert to everything. I learn fast when I'm getting information. I think the more interesting question that I'm trying to answer now is how do I split my attention between what seems to be a very busy internal company mm-hmm. management and the stuff that comes with needing to explain to our customers, our bank customers, the agencies. I mean, we're meeting with the main agencies, building relationships and engaging in education processes.
Yeah.
How do I split my time well between the two? Because my personal bias is towards heads down execution.
Yeah, yeah.
I enjoy the outside parts, but I enjoy the outside parts that have more to do with the growth and product innovation of the company.
You're a builder.
And yeah, I'm a builder by nature. I now have to prioritize engagements with people who are other stakeholders in this ecosystem. And even if these engagements don't make a net new advancement for the company, there's so much value in building trust and building education. And one of the things that we keep going back to is when things are hard, what makes you you and just double down on yourself? So when things are challenging from a regulatory standpoint and the ecosystem seems to be slowing down, and we want to find a way to productively get out of this and help the ecosystem get out of this, I don't believe in media manipulations. I don't believe in fights on social media. What makes us us is what we want to double down on. What makes us us historically is we're very heavy in writing and documenting publicly. And you know, you can dig up hundreds of pieces of materials, docs and guides and things that Unit publish to the ecosystem. And of course you can dig up one or two words that you might want to suggest to change, but the act of building in public is something we're very proud of. So we're going to keep doubling down on that and maybe educate a different set of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. We're good at building personal relationships. We're good at building software. We're good at thinking first principles. I mean, the things I told you today about disputes and 1099-90 forms, they're passionate arguments that we have about how to reduce risk, how to make things better for the banks, for the tech companies that work with them. Like this is the stuff that we enjoy doing. And I think if you change your nature in difficult times, you're going to completely lose your mind. And we're just doubling down on what makes us us. And I'm just very proud of the culture, the product and the ecosystem around Unit, and excited for the next few years.
You should be, man. And I'll say the last part because I think you're too humble and not the right person to say it, which is I was having a conversation this morning. This is my third podcast of the day. And I was having a conversation with, I'll leave the person unnamed, but a very respected fintech thought leader in the space. And I was like, I'm going over to Unilater, going to have a conversation with Atai. And they're like, ah, man, that back and forth and all that, you know, that we don't need to get into. But the thing that he said was, and he was talking to me as if like, I haven't known you for a while. He was like, you know, the thing about it is Atai and the unit, those are good people. And that is rare inside of this industry generally. I mean, I talked about the fiduciary broker dealer thing, but it's even more rare, I think, in this weird world where we put Patagonia vests together with suits, right? Like this finance and technology could inherently be the douchiest, meanest place on earth, like by combining these two entities.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And you've been a fucking mensch since I've met you. Mm-hmm. And everybody that I've ever met from Unit, the fact that you could get Alex Acree to come work here says an unbelievable amount about the company, the culture, and like whatever the hell is happening in the zeitgeist by the time this comes out. And that's why we tried not to talk too much about the zeitgeist today. It's good people building a company with increasing amounts of knowledge every day. And complexity.
We have so much more to prove.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing, I mean, I agree completely and double down on what you just said, because you've grown, but you are still inherently the same kind of person that I met in 2019.
Thank you.
Like the way, like I was like a little kid at a community bank and you treated me as if I was a meaningful human that you were actually going to engage with.
You are a meaningful human, Zach. I know,
but you believe that, but not, I've worked at other companies, one that you know, where the CEO doesn't think that way about humans, mm-hmm. right? Like that is not the standard way of thinking about the world. Mm-hmm. And that alone, I think manifests itself in the culture, manifests itself in like the way you guys show up in the world. And like, I'm fucking supporting you.
Thank you. We will be enjoying this journey as long as it helps us express our deep nature. It stops being fun once you stop being yourself in a business. And all the things I mentioned that define us, I mean, we have this saying of fierce but kind. We're fierce builders, but we're kind people.
It's actually you in the nutshell. Like, yeah. You scare the shit out of me, but I love you to death.
I could do that. Practicing being a builder, practicing sharing things publicly, even if it exposes you to criticism or, you know, otherwise people picking on some things, building good relationships. And look, we have a lot more to prove. I mean, this ecosystem hasn't grown even $100 million company in revenue. I mean, there's still more to do to get there.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about making this work. We have such a chip on our shoulder as far as proving all these things. And there's so much more to prove. I mean, there are big companies that can bleed money into the space and that they can do it for 5 more years. Mm-hmm. There are other companies like us that have a more finite and more precise way of operating, but nothing is guaranteed. I mean, we're here trying to build something that we think can make a dent in financial services. It's not guaranteed that in 10 years, JP Morgan won't be the winners. We think that they won't be. And we think that the world needs something better than, you know, another bank account that behaves like a bank account. We believe all these things need to be smart money. But we have so much more to prove. I mean, the world would not become as fun or easy without infrastructure. I mean, I'm just, you know, I spent
nerdiest
time across,
ever.
Dude, I can nerd out for hours about infrastructure. I mean, it's just the way you can elevate, I mean, just, you know, the stuff you take for granted, electricity, water, you know, bridges. The pipes in this building, bridges, roads, universities, hospitals, schools, like all these things have such a meaningful contribution to things around us. And I'm not trying to like dress up my ambition to succeed and build a big company with that. I also want to succeed and build a big company, but I think it's a measure of It's a way to prove that you've built something useful, and useful is beautiful to me. And I think that there's so much useful stuff to be built in financial services, and it's on us and other companies to prove that it can be built sustainably. And it's on the agencies and other stakeholders in this ecosystem to root for these outcomes. Mm-hmm. And there's so much more to build. I mean, I think that the world can be a very different place in 10 years, and I think it will be, but it's not guaranteed. There's no inevitable future.
I love it. That's a great place to leave it. Atai, thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah,
and now
based on
the way we left it, we have to do a check-in in like, you know, 6-12 months and then keep doing
years.
It for a decade. Yeah. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you're still listening, you're probably reaching for your phone to pick your next podcast or switch to music or just call it a day because you can't believe how much valuable information you just took in. But before you pick that next thing, don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, and all that jazz. Generally scream from the rafters about how much you love FinTech Family Hour. Thank you again to our sponsor, FS Vector. And until next time, stay healthy, keep your head high, your costs low, and I love you all.